This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from President Peggy Polk of Project PER about the report that cats are a lethal species. We'll talk with Peggy Polk about the report that indicates that cats may kill up to 3.7 billion birds every year in the United States. Also on the show, we are scheduled to hear from former State Representative Michael Jackson, who ran, of course, for Congress as an independent and perhaps cost Don Cashew the 6th District Congressional seat. Michael Jackson on the firing of Dwayne White as police chief in Baton Rouge and much more, including health care and Governor Jindal's stance on Obamacare. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. Please call 877-217-5757, and you may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest, Michael Jackson, the former state representative. He was born in 1965. This guy was born in 1958. But I'm sure you've been teased a bit through the years. And Kevin Gallagher is joining the...
That's how you start a show, Jim.
Says, I want you back. That was his first hit, by the way.
It was.
Okay. We get the idea, Kevin, but thanks. Michael Jackson, you were in the legislature for a dozen years, and you certainly follow what's going on in Baton Rouge. And yesterday was a big day. The chief of police, Dwayne White, canned. Out. What's going on?
Ouch. I tell you, there's never a dull moment in Baton Rouge. And I think this, more than anything, it's though we knew a little bit about the evaluation process that the mayor's office was going through with not only Chief White, but also 12 other heads of offices in the city of Baton Rouge, this still kind of took me by surprise. And I think it took me by surprise because Chief White, yes, did things a little bit different. And I think he built up great rapport in Baton Rouge in the community. And I think that he built up a lot of good faith and credit worthiness. Especially among the African-American community, that he really cared about the plight of crime. And I'm not going to prejudge the administration on their decision. I think that, of course, we will find out a lot more as time goes on and understand it a little bit better. But I must say that it did catch me a little bit off guard.
297-5633, if you'd like to comment. Now, the mayor refused comment about the reasons for White's dismissal. He emerged, as the advocate reports, from a side door in his office at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Both he and William Daniel, his chief administrative officer, said that they won't comment on personnel decisions. Well, they commented when the man was hired. That's a personnel decision. But why is it different when he's fired?
Well, that's a great question, Jim. And, you know, the lawyer in me will probably say that there's reasons that they don't want to comment. Because of the potential for possible litigation. And if so, I think it was a smart move on the mayor's behalf to not comment about it.
Well, why don't they just say that rather than say we don't comment on personnel decisions, which is what both the mayor and the chief administrative officer said. And obviously they do comment on personnel decisions when it's in their interest to do so. It's just like these All-American teams for college football, college basketball. They list the grade point averages. Their universities like LSU are proud when somebody makes a 3.5 or a 3.6. But when they make a 1.5 or a 1.6, suddenly it's the Buckley Amendment. We can't reveal anything about these athletes' grades. Well, they reveal it when it's good news, but they won't do it when it's bad news. Same thing yesterday with Chief Dwayne White.
I'd have to agree with you. And I think that the public will get more information as time goes on. But I suspect that they had their reasons for not commenting.
All right. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. The mayor was on this show 2 months ago on the 5th of December, and this is how he responded when asked whether Dwayne White would be retained.
What about the police department? The mayor chooses the chief. Are you going to stay with Chief White?
We're going to stay with the chief, but we're going to also have a sit down and talk about where we want to go.
All right. So the sit down and talk part must not have gone well.
Obviously not. And I think there's a lot more to the story. I think the chief publicly commented about some of the problems he was having with the police union. I don't know if that's the reason why, nor am I speculating, but clearly there was a reason for not retaining Chief White, and the public, I think, deserves an opportunity to understand just what happened.
Carl Davity, a lieutenant, is now going to be the interim chief. Do you know anything about him?
Not a thing. But that's not to say a whole lot. From my understanding about he comes from a police family, that he's had he served with the Baton Rouge City Police for an extensive period of time, and that he's well received by at least the police department. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, Dwayne White lasted less than 2 years. He was hired on May 27th, 2011, and he's gone on February 6th, 2013. So it was a quick exit for Chief White, and we'll see what happens with Lieutenant Davity and perhaps somebody after him. But a question from Cindy downtown. She writes, since the majority of crime in Baton Rouge is black on black, does Baton Rouge need to hire a black police chief?
I don't think the issue is black on black crime. I think when you approach the issue of crime, you approach it as crime in general. Chief White, I think, had a unique approach to dealing with crime. He engaged the community, and he was not an African-American. So obviously he was making some progress. If you'd ask some of the leaders in the African-American community that Chief White's presence in that position, they felt some value of him being there. So I don't think that you necessarily have to be an African-American to deal with the crime issue in Baton Rouge.
Well, do you have some qualities that you'd like to see the next chief have, or particular background?
Well, I think a diverse background in law enforcement, I think, mm-hmm. is important. I think that having some experiences maybe outside of Baton Rouge City Police is something that might want to be considered. I think that the ability to reach the community and play the politics of the position, I think, are very important attributes. You need someone who's able to identify with people in general, mm-hmm. and understand their plight, and build rapport and faith in addressing criminal problems in Baton Rouge. I think that White did a good job of that, and I think that the next police chief needs to consider greatly continuing the BRAVE program, the Violence Elimination mm-hmm. Project in Baton Rouge. I think that it was making headway, and I think people began to have faith in the system. For the longest, I think there was not very much faith in the system.
Well, Chief White is instrumental in starting BRAVE, the project you just mentioned to reduce gun violence in high crime areas, and in particular the 70805 zip code. You know that zip code
Absolutely.
Pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Michael Jackson, former state representative from Baton Rouge, is with us, a Democrat turned independent back to Democrat, and he is here to talk about a few other things as well. A varied group of organizations this week urged the governor to agree to the Medicaid expansion included in the Obamacare provisions. Medicaid expansion could provide health coverage to 400,000 Louisianians, and most of them are uninsured. Governor says he's not going to do it, even though some governors who are Republicans in states like Ohio and Arizona and New Mexico, Nevada, North Dakota, they've altered their positions. The governor has said no way. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a sad day for Louisiana in a number of in a lot of respect. Healthcare, I guess, in general, was something I worked on when I was in the legislature, so I'm a little bit more passionate as it relates to the issue than some might believe. But not only will 400,000 Louisianans not have an opportunity to be insured, But there's a tremendous impact that is not going to be addressed as it relates to hospitals in Louisiana. Because the portion of money called disproportionate share dollars that would normally go to hospitals are going to be, the federal government is going to decrease that funding by the tune of $18 million between now and 2018. So there's an impact personally to the people that would be insured. There's an impact to hospitals that we haven't adequately addressed. And also there's an impact to the overall quality of life to the citizenry and to the communities of Baton Rouge. We lead the nation. When you look at from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, when it comes down to AIDS and HIV, we lead the country in the number of new cases in AIDS and HIV. The quality of life is in question. Not only that, to add to that, we don't even get the benefit of our tax dollars that we send to Washington when we turn down opportunities for funding, especially direct funding that would benefit citizens. It's a sad day for our state when we can't put the partisan politics aside and address the fiscal concerns of our people and of our state.
The governor issued a statement. He did not publicly speak about this issue a couple of days ago. He says Medicaid relies on an outdated model that costs taxpayers billions of dollars and produces poor outcomes. He says the expansion could cost Louisiana more than $1 billion in 10 years. The irony, though, is that the money saved the first 3 years would happen on his watch.
Right.
So for his own budget monitoring, as far as him being in office and counting the dollars, being the bean counter of all bean counters in the state, it would seem to help him, but he's saying no.
Well, if I believe that if they would do the cost-benefit analysis rather than just speaking in general terms, allow the legislative process to work and allow the legislature to do its job, you'll find out that the benefit outweighs the risk. And there is a direct impact to the quality of life of the people of the state of Louisiana. So, I think he's wrong on that issue. I don't think he's counted the cost benefit. And the fact of the matter is that healthcare reform is here to stay. The Supreme Court has decided that it could be implemented. But it did give the states the choice to decide whether or not it would participate in Medicaid expansion. So hopefully we'll do the analysis. We'll go through the process and do an actual cost-benefit analysis and find out really whether or not it benefits the state. Hospitals ought to be up in arms right now. Mm-hmm. The Baton Rouge General, the Lady of the Lake, Lane Memorial are going to be impacted in a great way. And these issues ought to be brought to the forefront.
Michael Jackson is our guest, 12 years in the state legislature. During that time, you worked with a few governors. Did you ever have any one-on-one meetings with this governor?
Not one-on-one. Governor Jindal rarely met with legislators on a one-to-one basis. If you can get him with a group of legislators, I think you were doing pretty good. But it was not his style to meet with legislators. You'd meet with members of his staff for the most part. And the staff was probably a little bit more involved and engaged than the governor was.
Daryl on College Drive. Daryl, you're on with Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I just want to say good morning to your guests. One quick point is that I think a lot of times when we talk about the decisions that the governor is making, we fail to just come straight out and say that he's making decisions that are not necessarily in the best interest of the state of Louisiana, but in the best interest of a Republican Party primary a few years from now.
All right. What about that? Is the governor looking more at Des Moines than Baton Rouge?
Well, clearly, I think if you look at the way he's couching positions on various issues, health care, taxes now. He's joined a few governors in dealing with taxes and trying to set the agenda for tax reform in the state of Louisiana and the country.
297-5633, back with Michael Jackson after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 877-217-5757, your number, wherever you are. Michael Jackson, former state representative, three-term office holder in Baton Rouge, and a former congressional hopeful. He is with us. Governor Jindal, like many other Republican governors, declined to embrace the key part of the Affordable Care Act, referred to Obamacare, claiming it would be too costly for the state in the long run, and there's not enough flexibility to design a program that meets state needs. Some other Republican governors have backtracked. Governor Jindal has not, and there are those, including former Representative Jackson, who say that Medicaid expansion could provide health coverage to 400,000 people in our state, most of whom are currently uninsured. We'll talk more about this tomorrow with Chief Medical Officer for Blue Cross Blue Shield, Dr. David Carmouche. Bruce in Walden. Good morning, Bruce. You're on the air with Representative Jackson.
Yeah, good morning. I couldn't think of an issue that's more vital to particularly the poor and people of color in Louisiana. I'm wondering what former Representative Jackson's thoughts are about what do we do about it?
All right.
Well, I think we have to continue to be vigilant and talk about the issue. We have to raise the awareness of the general population about the opportunity for the citizenry to be insured, the overall impact both economically and quality of life wise are issues that need to be talked about. I mean, what if you have the state of Mississippi or Arkansas who has Medicaid expansion and has implemented different aspects of health care reform, and the state of Louisiana doesn't have that? What does that say about the quality of life, the overall quality of life for our state? I think it's a pretty sad commentary to say that we're offering less to our citizens than our neighboring state. And I think we have to be vigilant and talk about these issues and get them before our representatives to let them know the importance of them.
297-5633 for Michael Jackson. Dorothy in Goodwood. Dorothy, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to know if you think that maybe some of these bills that Governor Jindal is coming up with are out of the ALEC playbook, particularly on education.
She says the ALEC playbook is the governor taking his cues from this legislative group that is prominent around the country.
Well, it could be ALEC. It could be just the I'm running for president playbook that he's developed for himself. But clearly, he's talking about issues that are going to be galvanizing issues in 2016, issues that he can at this point begin to dictate and demand control the conversation. The issue of taxes is a much broader issue that I think the nation is going to be engaging. Washington is always trying to find a way to make our tax process simpler. And so he's jumped on that issue and has gotten in front of it. And he's attempting to dictate the tempo of the conversation.
297-5633. This is a philosophical collision here. And the governor, despite people's conjecture about his motives, has a consistent political philosophy. This is in line with what he's been espousing since he entered politics as head of the Department of Health, as secretary in 1996. There's nothing new here. The governor has been reelected convincingly. He was elected without a runoff. The people have embraced his philosophy, and he's governing with what he believes to be a mandate. Do you think he has a mandate, Michael Jackson?
Well, I think that he certainly got reelected. Whether or not he has a mandate is, at this point in his tenure, I think is unsure. But I think his position on taxes has shifted a bit. I think that when he first came in, in fact, he's done a lot of flip-flopping on taxes. When he first came in, he didn't want the legislature to overhaul the Stelly plan. He got behind it after it was very apparent that it was something that certain folks in the public want to support, and then he started this run of we're not going to deal with taxes at all, and certainly rejected the cigarette tax. Now he proposes to approach taxes tax reform in the state of Louisiana, and he's talking about the cigarette tax. He's talking about some aspect of sales tax. And not only he, but you've got the governor of Kansas and also the governor of Nebraska who are proposing similar things in their states as it relates to sales tax. And it's the stepping stone to a much broader conversation, I believe. And what is the best tax policy for an evolving economy in the 21st century? Whether or not that tax ought to be based on consumption or whether or not it ought to be based on some idea of fairness and based on income tax. So I think that clearly he's taking the opportunity to talk about the issues that are important not only to Louisiana but also to the nation.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Michael Jackson. Phil?
Yes, sir. Hello?
You're on the air.
Okay. And my question is, this is not about doing what's good for the state. It's following an ideology and a theology of the Republican Party. I mean, they cut taxes, they privatize government services, and they bust unions and also take out jobs. I mean, they're good jobs with pensions and benefits, or they go after that. This is all about playing with the big boys and doing for the corporations. You definitely are not going to do anything that would damage the oil industry or get them to pay for the damage that they've done to the state. I think it's a larger plan. There's nothing new there, and there's nothing that the majority of our state wants to see happen.
Mike?
Well, I think you're on point, and I think that when we talk about the health care initiative and Medicaid expansion and the implementation of the healthcare exchanges in our state, you're talking about benefits that will be received directly by people that will impact the lives of people. I can think about my time in the legislature, and those instances where we directly impacted the lives of people were very, very rare. I would say 70 to 80% of everything that we did revolved around the economics of business and whether or not we're creating a proper business environment for the state of Louisiana. This is one of the rare occurrences where we have an opportunity to impact the lives of people, and I truly believe that it's one that should be taken, especially when the federal government is footing the bill. And not only are they footing the bill for the first two years, but it would not go beyond 90% of investment on the state of Louisiana.
Polly asks, do you regret running for Congress as an independent?
No, I don't. For me, that issue tends to come up. And for me, it was an issue of making sure that our democracy has a chance to work effectively. And I relish the opportunity to participate and to give people an opportunity to decide on candidates based on their ideas and their character, as opposed to ideas that really don't or shouldn't have a great deal of impact on how we vote.
Priscilla says the governor's rejected the Medicaid money, or he is. He's rejected broadband money from the feds and also the rail system to New Orleans money. That's something that is near and dear to your heart.
Right. I will say that though there was a rejection of the concept, it wasn't a total rejection of the rail initiative. We were able to move the regulation of rail from the state to locals, and there's a revolution going on, at least an evolution in rail that's going on in the state of Louisiana. As you probably have heard of recently, that it is still alive between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. The municipalities and the parishes along the corridor are accepting the idea and have agreed to work under the Louisiana Intrastate Rail Compact. And we should be having our first meeting in March. So I'm excited that the program is still moving forward and that people are still excited about it. And I think it's because of the public's interest in this issue that it's still alive. And I believe that we'll have some rail between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And when you talk about Baton Rouge and New Orleans, you'll be talking about them as sister cities at some point.
Well, how's it going to happen without the governor's support?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that when you remove the regulation of the project from the state to the locals, the law actually gives the locals an opportunity to come up with ideas on how to fund it. There was a study that came out of UNO's Transportation Studies Department, John Renee, that stated that the increased property values along the corridor and the taxes that would be associated with it could support the rail concept. So clearly there are the funding mechanism out there outside of the state, relying on the state, and that's what we were hoping for, was to come up with some different ideas.
Doesn't it still need the governor's support and legislative approval?
Well, ultimately, the governor always has the ability to influence most projects of this magnitude in the state of Louisiana, but it does give the locals an opportunity to move the project forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if New Orleans and Baton Rouge and Ascension and Jefferson and some of the other parishes have put up their tax dollars to support a rail between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, I think it's going to be hard set for this governor or any governor to reject it.
Well, thank you, Michael Jackson. Always good to visit with you.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Let's do it soon. Again. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. In just a moment, we'll hear from Peggy Polk, president of Project PER, and a story that was first reported last week. This from the New York Times, and there were, of course, newspapers across the land that had the same report. For all the adorable images of cats that play the piano and flush the toilet and meow melodiously and find their way back home after hundreds of miles being away, scientists have identified a shocking new truth. Cats are far deadlier than anyone realized. It's estimated that cats kill 3.7 billion birds a year in the United States of America, and maybe up to 12.3 billion mammals a year, most of them native animals like shrews, chipmunks, and there are some reports now that cats may not be as lovable as we thought. Peggy Polk, president of Project PER, what do you think?
It's hard for me to actually take a statement like that seriously. If you think about it just on the logical brain level, cats can't fly. So for them to actually be able to get into the air and predate on a bird is kind of laughable. But let's just suspend disbelief for a moment and assume that cats are, able to take flight. You would actually have to say that you don't believe a lot of scientific studies that have proven that to the contrary. Yes, cats do catch an occasional bird, but in general, those are fledglings. Those are going to be the ones that are injured or sick and somehow have lost the ability to get into the air.
So you're disputing the report.
I'm just going to present the arguments on either side. I mean, their argument is that cats are able to get into the air and catch birds. And I mean, from just like I said, just thinking about it logically, that's cats can fly. I've never seen one, but okay.
They can jump.
Yeah. But if you, again, just thinking about on a logical level with all mm-hmm. of these ground dwelling small organisms that are ready for cats to catch as prey, why would they try and go into the air and catch a bird? The bird would have to be flying very low, number one. Number two, there have been...
Haven't you seen that happen?
I personally have not seen that, but if I did, I'd want my video camera. let's look at the real evidence that's out there. First of all, there have been 30 plus studies across four continents, utilizing scientific method, by the way, rather than those so-called witch hunters that have just kind of made up these statistics. So if you look at those scientific studies across the four continents, they have conclusively shown that the species which are predated by cats are predatory species, but they weigh 10 pounds. And so, and they're ground dwellers. And so the primary species that they predate on are small reptiles, small snakes, lizards, salamanders, frogs, toads, small rodents, and then insects and worms. That's what they predate on.
Let's go to some of our listeners who are standing in line to talk to Peggy Polk, president of Project PER. And you're a veterinarian?
No,
You're not?
Human vet. I'm
okay.
A physician.
Okay, all right. Okay, but you're a physician.
Right.
And you deal with cats. And
I
of course, and of course, you're head of an organization that is striving to save cats. And,
we rescue from the kill list at the Baton Rouge Public Shelter.
So the report was issued by scientists from the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the Fish and Wildlife Service, estimating that domestic cats in the United States kill a median of 2.4 billion birds and 12.3 billion mammals a year. Peggy Polk says the numbers may be a bit suspicious.
Well, that's some talented cats that are able to do that.
Wade at Louise. Wade, good morning. You're on the air with Peggy Polk. Hi, Wade.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has had a section on cat predation for many, many years, and it's primarily on the devastation to the songbirds. And I personally would rather sit on my deck and listen to songbirds in the morning than have to listen to, in the middle of the night, a couple of cats fighting over my deck as their territory. And I think it's kind of disrespectful for the speaker to sit there and try and trivialize something that's very, very serious for people who really like birds and songbirds. And I'll take her.
Hold on, Wade. Yes. Do you think outdoor cats should be euthanized?
I think the feral cats, yes, should be euthanized. And I think people who go out and feed feral cats are really doing our society a disservice, and they really ought to be hauled in and taken to the SPCA. Yeah.
All right. Peggy, would you respond?
Okay. I appreciate your comments, and I respect your opinion. Too many studies have actually been provided too much conclusive evidence to the contrary. A 1993 study by the Center of Conservation Biology at Stanford University found that environmental loss caused the decline of the songbird in particular. A 1994 World Watch Institute study showed that four primary factors are responsible for bird decline, and those have been repeated. Those are the ones that the 30-plus studies across the four continents have shown, that the true cause of bird decline is habitat loss through deforestation and forest fragmentation, followed by drought, followed by pesticides, those primarily being lawn care and farm products, and then overtrapping and hunting. There's just too much evidence to the contrary, but let's suspend disbelief for just a moment and then take into account his comments.
All right, hold your fire, and we'll be back with Peggy Polk of Project PER about cats. Are they killers? We'll talk more after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Peggy Polk of Project PER is here disputing a report issued last week by the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the Fish and Wildlife Service, estimating that domestic cats in the United States, just in the U.S., kill between 2.4 billion birds and 3.7 billion with a B birds every year in the United States. And Wade at Louis was first in line, saying that he'd rather have a songbird on his porch than a cat. I'm a cat lover. I have a couple of cats. They're indoor cats, but what about these cats that are out roaming the streets at night? What do you think, as a person who is trying to save these animals, what should be done about them?
Okay, well, let's just ignore the wide body of evidence out there and suspend disbelief and conclude that cats are the actual villains that some alarmists claim. So what then? Well, first of all, let's look at the reality of the situation. The colonies of wildcats tend to occur in places where there are transient populations of people, so those being apartment complexes, tourist attractions, restaurants, shopping malls, vacation spots, hotels, places where people tend to waste food and discard it into dumpsters, number one, and then in those same spots, the true animals, which are predated by cats, those being mice and insects, those tend to aggregate in places where there are dumpsters as well. And there tends to be, in those same spots, places in which they can take shelter from the elements. So these are man-made habitats that we have created for these large numbers of wild cats out there. Are we going to bust down all of these establishments so that we can take away the wild cats' habitats? Well, I don't think anybody's going to try and sell anybody that that's the solution. So what is the solution? And there have been studies to look at the solution to the issue of the proliferation of the large numbers of wild cats, which are increasing in the United States.
Marcia in Clinton. Marcia, you're on the air. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Well, first off, the only safe cat is an indoor cat. So indoor cats don't predate on birds or anything else unless a mouse gets in the house. But as far as the feral problem is a man-made or a person-made problem. People dump unwanted cats, and there are the dumpsters and things that have been mentioned. Control through neuter-spay programs and education of the public not to dump animals would be go a long way towards stopping the explosion of the feral cats.
Peggy?
Yes, there are a large number of feral cats for whatever problem, for whatever cause. And as I was saying, the solution to the proliferation of wild cats in our country, well, number one, we could break down all of the places where feral cats find their habitat, those being man-made establishments, the restaurants, the shopping malls, the tourist attractions, the apartment complexes. Or we could do what has the only solution which has been shown to work thus far in the evolution of this problem, and that is trap, neuter, return. By Humane Society of the United States estimates, in our area alone, there are 60,000 free-roaming wild cats. These are cats that you're never going to be able to domesticate and bring inside. And these are cats that, unless something is done, they're going to continue reproducing. Cats are very efficient at proliferating, and they're also good at surviving in the wild because they can find.
What about people who go to these shopping malls and feed these cats? Should they continue to do this?
It doesn't matter. The food source is there anyway. At every shopping mall,
so they don't even
there
have
is
to.
Discarded food. At every shopping mall, there are lots and lots of mice and rats and other small rodents and salamanders and small amphibians. They're going to be there, and unless you tear down that shopping mall, you have provided a habitat for feral cats. So what is the solution? Catch and kill. Up until recent decades, that was the solution that was advocated by folks. And that was done. And you see how well that has worked.
Okay.
Why doesn't it work? Because they're highly avoidant of people. These are wild animals. They're highly avoidant of people. They view us as predators. And rightfully so, by the way. And thus our ability to round them all up and kill them at one time is non-existent. We can certainly trap many of them at a time. But once those cats have been removed, if the food supply remains constant, if you don't take away the dumpsters and you don't break down your shopping malls and your apartment complexes, the remaining ones will efficiently reproduce right back to their critical mass. That's called vacuum effect. You take a large number of them out, you're leaving the other ones unsterilized, and they're going to reproduce right on back to where you started out. The more efficient method of getting rid of the only thing that's been shown to work, as a matter of fact, is called what's called trap, neuter, return. And that's what I was starting to talk about earlier. Trap, neuter, return says you set the humane traps out, you put food in them, they go in, And then you bring them to the vet, you bring them to the vet, sterilize them, and then release them back to colony. And repeat that until you've gotten at least 70% of the cats.
All right.
Once you've done that, you now have a colony of sterilized cats that are still going to catch the mice, they're still going to eat the bugs, they're still going to eat the discarded food, but cats are territorial. They're going to guard their territory, so they're going to keep new cats from being able to come in.
Greg in Lafayette. Greg, good morning. You're on the air. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. While I fully appreciate and support Ms. Polk's position, I think she greatly diminishes her credibility by making this ridiculous argument about cats flying. Clearly, that's not at all the proposition of the Smithsonian's report. By the same token, birds don't catch their worms in the air, and they don't nest in midair. Cats catch birds on the ground, and they can climb trees. And if you haven't seen cats on the ground chasing birds or cats climbing trees, you need to get out more.
Peggy?
I do need to get out more.
Greg, made your point, and the new study from the Smithsonian estimates that free-roaming pets account for only about 29% of the birds and 11% of the mammals killed by domestic cats each year. The larger problem is how to manage the 80 million or so stray and feral cats that commit the bulk of the wildlife slaughter. And Peggy Polk is in the business of saving cats. But when I got a couple of cats from Project Purr, I had to sign an agreement saying they would not go outdoors.
Yeah, we do have an indoor-only policy for our pet cats. And I don't think anybody's arguing the issue for the owned cats, the domesticated cats. I think the controversy surrounds the feral cats.
So you're not in favor of widespread euthanization of these cats, though?
It is ineffective. It doesn't work. It doesn't matter whether I'm in favor of it. It's a waste of taxpayer money, and it doesn't work. The only thing that we've been able to find thus far that works is sterilizing them. And by the way, the trap-neuter return is somewhat inefficient. It requires a lot of volunteer time. I have worked in trap-neuter return programs before, and it's very tough work. The volunteers that work in that area are true heroes. Truly right. Heroes and dedicated to what they're doing. Chemical sterilization is coming down the pike, and that will be a whole lot more efficient.
Melanie in the Garden District. Good morning, Melanie. You're on with Peggy Polk.
Hi. I appreciate this opportunity to comment. I am the Director of Bird Conservation for the Gulf Coast for National Audubon Society, and just wanted to comment that there are only a few very rare situations where trap-neuter release is effective. As soon as animals are fed, which they typically are in a returned colony, they lose their territoriality. So cats, once they've been put in a colony, are no longer territorial. If even one unsterilized cat comes into the population and meets another unsterilized cat, you have continued addition to the population, and so colonies actually add cats to a population. The only possibility of that working is on an island where there's a completely closed population, and 100% of the animals of the cats can be trapped and neutered. So it doesn't tend to be a good solution for birds or for small mammals. And it can lead to disease and other infections for the cat. So it's not necessarily helpful for cats either.
And so what is your proposed solution?
What is your proposed solution, Melanie?
I don't have a specific proposed solution, but I do know that there's a tremendous amount of trouble with trap-neuter release, and it can be very harmful to birds that are at risk. And that really getting people to keep cats indoors and trying to deal with feral cats a different way is often most appropriate.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment. I don't think anybody is arguing the viewpoint of keeping owned household pets inside only. I mean, it's win-win for everybody. Again, the question that is being debated is that of the large number, an increasingly large number of feral cats. I don't think you're going to find too many people that are willing to keep those indoors.
Trish in Grand Coteau. Trish, please be brief. You're on with Peggy. Hi, Trish.
Hi. I agree with the caller from Lafayette who says You really devalue your argument when you talk about cats flying. Anybody's ever owned a domestic cat knows that they will bring you birds as presents until you have a bird flopping around your house. So they obviously can catch them on the ground by going into trees. And my other comment is I have a lovely neighbor who has done the trap and release thing, and there are a number of feral cats where I live. It's pretty rural. But I have noticed there are fewer rats around, there are fewer snakes around. So in some ways, there is sort of a benefit to them in a way. And I think the solution is a combination of catch and release and educating people to not dump their cats.
Yeah, I agree. Are we going to demonize the cats and say that they are the prime cause of the decreasing number of birds instead of human beings through habitat loss, deforestation, forest fragmentation, overtrapping, drought, and pesticides and pollution?
All right. Well, do you fear that people will start being vengeful toward cats now as a result of this report? There are people, as we know, who are unkind to cats, kill them. I lived in Spanish Town for a few years, and I saw it firsthand. It's not a good thing. What do you think?
It's, I just have to do the serenity prayer. It's a felony to harm a cat in that way. It's punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a huge fine. So I would hope that people wouldn't break the law. To all of these people who decide that cats are the culprit in this problem instead of humans, my question is, what is your solution?
Paul in Lafayette. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Peggy Polk of Project PER. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'm a 70-year-old hunter, deer hunter, and I've spent a great deal of time out in the woods sitting on deer stands, and I can tell you for a fact that you see cats out in the woods fairly often. I just wanted to contribute that thought to the discussion.
So what does that mean?
It means they are wildlife.
Okay.
They're out there surviving on whatever is there to be taken to live off of, and I assume some of that is birds.
Okay. So I don't know if we're talking about this as much as we are birds in other places, but birds are birds, and 3.7 billion birds a year, that's a lot of birds. That's more birds than there are people in the United States, obviously, about 10 times more. So there are people, as we heard from Wade and Louise and others along the way this morning, Peggy, who believe that birds are more valuable to our society than our cats.
That's interesting. I really don't place a higher value of birds over cats or cats over birds.
In an ideal world, we wouldn't have any predators out there, but that's that's part of survival. We're predators as humans. Mm-hmm. So what do we do, if anything? Do we do nothing?
Well, again, I mean, you have to look at where we are in our evolution of solving this problem. And thus far, the only thing that has been shown to be even a little bit effective is trap, neuter, return. Now, I have a lot of faith in what's coming down the pike. I think we're going to probably 10 years from now be looking back on all this and saying, huh, trap, neuter, return, really? Chemical sterilization is going to be so much more efficient.
All right, Gina in Lafayette. Please be brief, Gina. You're on with Peggy.
Yeah, hi there. I was a licensed wildlife rehabilitator for 25 years here in Lafayette. And the damage that the cats have done, if you hold a baby bird in your hand that's been mangled by a cat, you'll see how distressing it is. And the return idea is no good because you're just putting them back out there to play in the trees and do the damage that they do. I think in all the money and effort that goes into trapping these cats and taking them in and bringing them back, I think if you gave a low-cost or free spay-neuter program to people who have the cats to start with, that they would keep them at home and they would not reproduce and keep putting more out there and dumping them.
All right. Kim in North Baton Rouge. Kim, please be brief, and then we'll get Peggy to respond to Gina and Kim. Hi, Kim.
Hi. My comment is to the response of, the number of cats versus the number of birds. well, the number of cats has exponentially increased because of domestication and people not having them, I don't know what the word is for cats, but fixed so that they don't reproduce unnecessarily, whereas birds have a natural timeline in which they reproduce, so their numbers don't increase by the number equal to the number of predators that they.
All right. Would you respond, Peggy? Thank you, Kim.
Sure. Yeah, that has actually been studied also, and nationwide in the United States, 90% of all people with owned cats have fixed their pets who make $50,000 a year and up, household income of $50,000 a year and up. Let's look at the ones who earn under $50,000 and have owned cats. For, of those, 50% who earn between $35,000 and $50,000 have fixed their animals.
Okay, we got to roll. But thank you, Peggy. Let's do this again soon. Hot topic in Baton Rouge and elsewhere. Until tomorrow, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.